morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Stefan Sedich, representing National Federation of Federal Employees this morning, sometimes referred to as NEFE. So you hear that. Today's appeal deals with the district court's grant of summary judgment pre-discovery with no motion hearing in our challenge to a drug testing policy put forth by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. In our view, the court essentially upheld a poorly drafted policy that designated a broad class of positions for drug testing, ranging from welders and drug and alcohol counselors to office clerks and purchasing agents, which we have, our view is unconstitutional, particularly because the court in this case relied upon very vague findings of public safety. Also really developed this idea of a role model rationale that is not, in our view, supported by the DC Circuit cases or the Supreme Court cases. And generally speaking, to the facts that maybe applied to all the employees really inferred them against us at this stage in litigation.
The district court referred to student safety, isn't that correct? Not public safety.
Student safety, exactly. And from that standpoint, if we don't disagree that if they could identify what exactly the safety was that they were worried about on the part of the students, they may have a rationale. But it just, a lot of it was just stating, you know, these employees are responsible for the safety of students without really getting into the meat and potatoes of what that safety actually is. There are some obvious things that go along with that, right? The driving issue is one of them. There is a real factual dispute over who drives, how often they drive. And so what the court did there was they said, well, yeah, there is a factual dispute over driving, but at some point somebody might drive somebody, and really, in our view, really relied on a lot of speculation, no factual.
What are the opposing factual submissions here on driving?
That, you know, everyone's in agreement that there are commercial driver license holders on these property that drive students. They're already subject to drug testing. Then the agency put forth evidence that there are non-CDL holders who do some driving, sometimes taking students to the store to buy clothing, sometimes taking them to medical appointments. We put in evidence of teachers and other positions where they haven't driven students in 9-10 years, if ever, and have real no expectation of driving. And so there is a real factual dispute on that point.
I thought the relevant factual dispute had to do with, well, maybe I shouldn't say factual, the relevant dispute here, maybe it washes over those facts, is whether people who do not regularly drive in students, indeed do not even regularly have contact with students, might nonetheless find themselves helping in an evacuation or other unusual circumstance where everyone's needed to use their vehicles to get children out.
And that's right. That's what the court really relied upon. And we think that...
What's the factual dispute about that?
Well, it's just very speculative of when there will actually be an evacuation. This policy was written...
Does that create a factual dispute, or is it simply something that you are able to argue diminishes the government's interest because it's not a regular or frequent occurrence?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I'm not, it probably more is to the point that if you look at what the facts are on the record, the government pointed to one specific evacuation, and this policy was written in 1995.
Even if there's never been an evacuation,
they can still point to it. That's speculative. So I think from that standpoint, yeah, I'm not sure there's a real dispute of how often these evacuations occur, other than that it seems that the facts that don't occur very often. But yeah, we would argue that, you know, where you're really relying heavily upon speculation that any particular employee is ever going to evacuate, a non-CDL holding employee is really ever going to drive someone in one of these evacuation scenarios, partly because there's not a lot of facts that these occur very often. But also, yeah, from the legal standpoint, once you start moving that line, and that's one of the really issues is that when you look at like sort of the driving cases, like the Uter case, where NTU put forth, hey, if you're going to start requiring anybody with a state-issued driver's license can be drug tested because they may drive, the court there said, you know, well, we think it's a pretty bright line between do you drive on behalf of the government or do you not drive on behalf of the government and you just use your vehicle to get to your work of employment. The government appears to be sort of blurring the lines there by saying, well, it could happen at some point during your 35-year career. I mean, so it really sort of a gray area of whether that where that line goes.
Is it a fair analogy? It was following a fair analogy. Over next door at the Department of Labor, there's a child care center, daycare center. It serves not only employees of that building, but courthouse and other employees. It's extremely unlikely that the building is going to have to be evacuated because of a fire. But somebody's responsible for making sure that those fire extinguishers are functional by testing them every whatever it is, let's say, month. It costs something. And it would be easy enough to say, well, look, this is very improbable. So to save money on the building budget, I'm going to defer the testing till to every 3 months or eliminate it altogether. Analogous situation? It's very unlikely there's going to be that fire, right?
I'm not sure it's analogous. I think the issue here is that the employees, I mean, that, in some sense, that's a policy matter, and someone's got to make a policy decision. Once they make the policy decision,
policy here from the USDA,
and then the question is, once you make the policy, it's fine to make the policy, and the agency clearly has the right to make the policy. But can they defend it as constitutional? And then you look at how often it's likely to happen.
We're going to get down to that, right?
Yeah.
But that's where you're at the next point about balancing. But the question is there anything, does the government have anything in its side of the way, of the balance, anything in its pan here that you have to weigh against, or is it empty? And you were telling us it's empty, basically.
Yeah, I mean,
Now it seems to me you're acknowledging that now they do have an interest.
Well, balanced against the fact that they already have people who are subject to random drug testing, who are the ones who actually operate the motor vehicles, who probably, you know, by the time you work your way down the ladder here, you already have the people who hold CDLs who are like the
evacuees work in these places, right? They have knowledge of how these operate. They've submitted affidavits.
Correct.
Have they put in anything about the ratio of staff to students or vehicles to students?
There is evidence in there. I'm not sure it's very fully developed. I think these centers have 60-passenger vans, which is why some people have to hold CDLs to drive them. I'm thinking they have one or two passenger vans, although I don't think the record's very fully developed on that.
Did you say 60
passenger vans, buses essentially.
Oh, okay, a bus.
I think they call them passenger vans, but there must be buses if they're that.
And so the
ratio between staff and so. There are large vehicles that carry a large number of students. There are a number of staff, and the number is escaping me right this second, but I think it's in the record, that, you know, the residential staff, including the people who work in the dorms, as well as the recreational assistants, they all hold CDL, so you're talking 10, 12 people, I think, at least on these centers out of 50 working union employees that hold CDLs.
Is there sufficient seating on the buses to take, or capacity, I should say, to take all of the students out?
And I think that's another one of these things that's unclear on the record. I mean, we didn't get to discovery.
Yeah, but this would be within the knowledge of your members.
Yeah, I mean, certainly our side would say there's never been an evacuation where the CDL holders weren't more than sufficient to evacuate the center. And again, the evidence of evacuations is actually very little, so there's not much to work with in that regard. And that's one of our points in the brief.
So you don't need evacuations to answer the question whether, in the experience of your members, there are sufficient vehicles lying around to evacuate all of the students if they all had to be evacuated at the same time.
Yes. My members would say evacuation's not a problem.
But it's not in the record.
I'm not sure. I don't think the record is very fully developed on that.
Well,
yeah, I mean,
that is to say, you didn't fully develop your
submissions. I think that's a fair point.
You don't have to concede that. I mean, you're making a constitutional challenge here.
Yeah, I mean,
the government has a burden.
And that's the real point is that to us, you know, there's the evacuation point was so little developed on their side, and they obviously would have wanted to play that up. That if they really had a lot of evidence to that point, they would have put in even more affidavits of real situations.
That might be because they had other rationales. I think the way I read the record or the government submission, the stronger rationale, at least that I saw, was not necessarily this possibility of an emergency evacuation, but the idea that these were at-risk youth in a remote location in an overnight boarding situation, and that you were asking for big trouble if you had employees there who were involved with drugs, particularly with the at-risk youth. So the combination of the location, the nature of the students, that created the special circumstances.
And that's another large part, certainly, of what the agency's rationale is. And, you know, NEFI's position there is the first thing to look at, they really play up the zero tolerance policy. Mm-hmm. And there's no doubt, we can see it obviously, that the Department of Labor came up with the zero tolerance policy, but the Department of Labor oversees 120 some odd Job Corps centers, and the Department of Labor has never put anything out that their employees have to be tested.
The difference here, I guess, is that these are schools where they are centers where they the at-risk youth live, right?
Well, I think that's
true of all of them.
I think that's true for a majority of the Job Corps centers.
What do you mean by what did the district court find as to at-risk youth?
I think she accepted the agency's argument that if you're in the Job Corps program, you're generally it's aimed at economically disadvantaged youth who generally, you know, a lot of times
are they at risk youth? At risk for what? The district court says they are economically disadvantaged youth, age 16 to 24. Well, that's her finding.
Well, and that's right. The program is aimed at economically disadvantaged youth. It's just. Then they take the facts that, you know, there are a certain amount of, you know, students who, enrollees who have tested positive for drugs at some
point. There's been a lot of prior drug use, right?
But by the end of her opinion, she concludes that we are talking about troubled and underprivileged youth who may already be prone to illegal drug use.
Do I think the court is trying to play up the at-risk portion to show that without these, if these staff are not all, randomly tested, that these youth could go off and trying to play up the the height of the risk, what could happen to these employees. And just like, you know, they put in Mr. Dawson's declaration, he said, I have instances where a student failed out of the program, and, you know, well, that may very well be possible, but I'm not sure that's a direct nexus between whether these staff, you know, whether the office clerk or the purchasing agent who purchased supplies, why do they need to?
Do you agree that some of the people there can be randomly drug tested?
And that's the whole thing. Is the aim of our litigation wasn't to say no one can be drug tested who wasn't previously drug tested. Our whole position was just don't be lazy in writing your policy, and why don't you analyze each position for whether you really can develop the nexus?
Is that a yes?
So we acknowledge there very well may be, like, here's a good example.
So maybe.
You know, let me give you an example. And they put in their things, welders. Welders obviously use equipment that are, you know, potentially dangerous. That nowhere is written in their policy. It doesn't seem that that was one of their main considerations when they wrote their policy in 1995. But, you know, intuitively, is welding a dangerous thing? Could they potentially establish a nexus? They very well might. But there's also case law out there, I think, from district court case in California analyzing it, and, you know, at least that court found, I think, a difference between types of welders. So there still might be a factual development to look at what the welders do and whether there really is a nexus between
the record showed that the welders are not these employees, that they come in. This is a vocational training program, that these people with expertise come in and train these youngsters, young people, and they are not subject to this policy, as opposed to the nurses who are employees who, because they have to have these commercial driver's licenses, they are subject to testing already.
And that's the point that we try to make on the contractors. It's sort of all over the place. There are some positions that are federal employees. There actually are some welders that are federal employees. There's other welders that are non-federal employees, and one group will be tested and one group won't be tested, all and right. It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense from a constitutional standpoint.
Do you want to save? We'll give you a minute or two in rebuttal.
From the bill, thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Mark Pennick, U.S. Department of Justice. I represent the Secretary of Agriculture and the Director of the U.S. Forest Service in this appeal. In the words of Judge Ginsburg, the government's pan on the balancing test is quite full. And it doesn't just extend to driving or plasma cutters or arc welders or the like. What we have here is a unique program involving remote residential facilities located deep in some wilderness, sometimes in Montana and sometimes in the Ozarks, and 18 states and U.S. Forest Service. These are civilian conservation camps, were probably built during the 30s. The whole point of this program is to take at-risk youths and remove them from the environment in which they were highly at risk of becoming jailed, killed.
Let's not go outside the record here.
But no, Your Honor, this is actually the record that's part of the, we're not going outside the record. These are congressional findings. You have the 1995 congressional
findings. Put that in a footnote, giving us a cite to the congressional findings, but the district court's reliance and what's before the district court is simply that there were these hearings and there was drug use.
Your Honor,
interestingly, we don't know whether, according to those findings, whether it was drug use by the enrollees or drug use by the employees.
This record contains very specific evidence about drug use by enrollees.
Eight people in recent years.
Those are employees, Your Honor, not enrollees. The Dawson affidavit shows, for example, that every single enrollee is tested for drugs by virtue, not because of some policy of the Department of Agriculture or the Department of Labor, because Congress mandates it. 2885A requires the Secretary of Labor to develop a policy that requires drug testing within 45 days of admission.
But let me just ask you, if the government is going to establish a program, does the government have any obligation to establish a program in a manner that does not necessitate interference with individuals' Fourth Amendment rights? Namely, we're only talking here about the employees. In other words, the district court relies heavily on the cases that, the early cases of the Supreme Court, where we were talking about public safety, railroads, airports, where lots of people were killed or injured as a result of studies showing that the pilots or the engineers were using drugs or alcohol. And the district court relies on the Vannonia case. And in that case, the school district pointed to all kinds of problems of discipline and that the intercollegiate athletes, who were supposed to be these models, were creating a rebellion at the school that was fueled by alcohol and drugs. And the school district had tried programs, it had tried drug-sniffing dogs, and then it went to the parents. And the parents unanimously agreed that these athletes should be drug tested. And as the Supreme Court wrote, the school district was at wit's end. Yet, the only students being tested there were the athletes, not the rest of the students in the schools. The teachers weren't being tested. Now we have a situation where we don't have that record, and we know that one of these places is deep in a forest. We don't know where all these other places are, and all the questions that Judge Ginsburg was raising, you know, we don't have that information yet.
Your Honor, I'd like to respond.
Okay.
Government's obligation is to do what this court in Steigel told it to do.
And let me just say in Steigel, so we're clear, We were talking there about the protection of the President and Vice President of the United States. If anything is of concern, at least to the generation of judges now on the bench who have lived through a presidential assassination.
And so have I, Your Honor.
And so have you. That is such a, as Justice O'Connor used to say, context matters.
Your Honor,
now we're talking about poor, economically poor young people who are seeking vocational training.
The test that the court addressed to Steigel, certainly the risk involved there went to the weighing process, and certainly the risk was extremely unlikely but so serious that the court weighed it. But the court's analysis of the balancing test is not limited to the facts in that case. The court said the nexus to be examined is not that between the job and the harm, but rather between the risk posed by the drug-using employee and the evil sought to be prevented. And that's the test we apply here.
I know, but what's the limit to this test that you're urging on the court?
It is, Your Honor, this case doesn't require the court to go much beyond where the court has already gone.
Where has the court gone that far?
Well, for example, and I'm looking at this Cheney case when the court said drug counselors, no, bear me out for a moment, drug counselors are required to undergo drug testing. Now, every single employee in one of these remote job course centers has a duty imposed on it by, as a condition of its employment, to monitor for drug use. Every single federal employee can set up one of these enrollees for on suspicion drug testing. Every single employee is required to mentor the proper behavior and to model the proper behavior. Every single one of these employees come into contact with students on a daily basis. This is really no different than the Ninth Circuit's position in the AFE case that we cite in the Bureau of Prisons, where the court sustained drug testing for every single employee that had contact with him, potential contact with prisoners in the federal prison, even though they didn't have firearms.
To pick up on Judge Rogers' question about the limit, do you think a school district could test all employees at a school?
Well, the Sixth Circuit sustained that in Knox County with respect to teachers and administrators, but this case doesn't require you to go that far.
I know, but I think we're looking to make sure what the limits of the government's position are, because we're getting farther and farther away from.
I don't think you go very far here. For example, my opponent says that, well, some of these guys don't drive. Well, they all might drive. This court in Harmon and in Harkness didn't inquire whether the employee had top secret or secret clearance every day or used it. It was said it was enough that he might, because the flexibility required by the use of that clearance required that all such employees be covered by drug testing.
But then we remanded to determine, you know, which categories of employees. It wasn't as broadly framed as
this court very clearly said in Harkness that that secret was enough, and you didn't have to inquire further. The court said the same in Harmon. The court said the same in the Ninth Circuit.
But access to secret documents that may affect national security. I mean, we're talking about kids at a vocational training school.
These kids, 25% test positive when they come to the drug service. This is after they've been told that they would be tested.
My point is, you know, they tested the students, not the teachers, not the counselors.
There was no incidence of drug testing, history of positive testing for drug counselors in Cheney, or for Bureau of Prisons individuals in the AFG case in the Ninth Circuit, or for that matter, the top secret employees in Harmon or secret employees in Harkness. You don't need to have a documented drug problem among employees to have a prophylactic situation where you have employees who are custodians, who are caretakers, who the safety of the students depends upon their ability to keep drugs out of that area and be available to evacuate and otherwise take care of individual students on a daily basis.
But that's true of people who work in hospitals.
No, it's not, Your Honor.
Yes, it is.
Because
it is true of people who work in schools, where the children are in school.
I disagree, Your Honor. We have a unique situation here. These are residential facilities in which the employees do not leave except where they're in the care of the individuals.
A hospital has overnight patients.
Well, that's true, Your Honor, but this is for 2 years. You have enrollees for 2 solid years, and the government, they have 2 years, and that's it, by and large, to turn their lives around.
So the argument drugs, is made that where you have an office-like setting, you don't need random drug testing.
An office-like setting.
Because the cook, everybody can be trained to be able to identify possible signs of drug use, and those people can be individually reported and tested.
We don't have an office setting here, Your Honor.
By office setting, meaning everybody is located on site. You don't have to go searching through the state trying to find these employees. They come there, they stay there, they deal every day, as you said, with this vocational training program.
Your Honor, it's much more than just a vocational training program. We're not just teaching them how to use an arc welder. We're teaching them how to turn their lives around. Every one of these members of the U.S. Forest Service or staff members here have a duty to model this behavior because they need to turn their lives around. Well, everyone has a duty to see to the safety of these individuals.
You know, the Secretary of the Department of Agriculture promulgated these regulations but didn't implement them for over 14 years.
Due to the opposition of the plaintiff in this
case? No. Look, but the point is, if this is so central to the operation of these Job Corps civilian centers, the fact that for 14 years they would wait, and the Department of Labor, as I understand it, according to this record, has yet to require random drug testing for employees.
Most of the Department of Labor sites are contract sites, and it's not clear whether the Department of Labor feels that it has the authority to require private contractors to undergo drug testing.
The relevant facts here are that it hasn't done it. It hasn't asked Congress for that authority, and it hasn't done it. So here we have the Forest Service, and as Judge Kavanaugh was recounting, I mean, one of the points here that the government urged were these remote settings.
And they are quite remote, Your Honor. In the Trapper Creek, that's 75 miles from the nearest medical facility.
But my point is that if they're remote, think of all of those that are located in urban centers where access to drugs presumably is that much more likely.
Your Honor, there may well be a case for doing drug testing in those centers as well. The fact that it hasn't happened doesn't undermine the interest of the government, if in Judge Ginsburg's words, the pan, how it's filled for these centers and for these employees who have unique.
Any time the government sets up a program to which citizens voluntarily enroll, and particularly if the program has a residential feature where it is not located in an urban community, where there is evidence that some of the enrollees have used drugs, all the employees can be subjected to random drug testing?
Your Honor, the matrix is larger than even that. We have not only the remoteness of these facilities, the far distance trauma centers. You have a drug overtest in Trapper Creek, the person's likely to die if he overdoses there because there's not going to be a hospital where you can take
them. Well, maybe the government has an obligation, if it sets up these programs, to set them up in places where it is possible, if the government takes the position that it has this safety obligation, to make certain that there are ways to evacuate in emergencies.
The goal of the program is not simply to get these individuals to be drug-free. That's the essential predicate for accomplishing the other goals, which is turning the lives around of these individuals who are highly at risk, and as one affidavit says, this may be their last chance. This is a situation where you take them remotely into the wilderness precisely to get them out of the urban centers so you can more successfully do that. I'm sorry.
Maybe you have some obligations.
We have an obligation to keep that place drug-free.
But as Judge Ginsburg was exploring with you, if you have a bus or 3 buses that can get everybody out there, then your obligation is to have 3 drivers who are drug tested randomly. But is it to test the cook, the automation person, the clerk?
And every one of those individuals has daily contact with staff members, with the enrollees.
Every one of them could be a conduit for drugs if they're using drugs. Every one of them has an obligation to report suspicious behavior, misbehavior by enrollees. Every one of those individuals uniquely is different than the standard federal employee in an office environment.
So it seems to me you have two big distinctions from some of the hypotheticals I've been raising and Judge Rogers has been raising. The residential facility, it's not just a place where they go every day, it's residential, and you could add remote to that, but I think the key is residential. And then there are at-risk youth. Can you tell me, because what's the criteria, what are the criteria for determining at-risk youth who come into this program?
It's actually set forth in the statute in 2884. Right. And that includes people who have, and I have the statute right here, rather than try to ad-lib this. It's in the statutory addendum to our brief. And there's just no doubt that you have individuals here who are truly at risk. And there's really no dispute between the parties about this. There is the low-income individual whose basic skills deficient, a school dropout, a homeless, a runaway, a foster child, an individual who requires additional education, vocational training, intensive counseling, and related assistance in order to participate successfully.
So far, what you have recounted is a fear that these people may, in the old days, we would say, end up on welfare.
No, Your Honor.
All right? To the contrary. It doesn't say anything there about drugs.
If you read the Dawson affidavits and the other affidavits that we've submitted that are part of this record, drugs is a huge problem. And they've mentioned this.
I understand that. But that's like drugs was a huge problem at the Veronia School District. And they tested the students, as Congress says. You say Congress has required all the enrollees to be tested here.
Congress has done more than that.
Didn't say that they were going to test the teachers,
Your Honor,
who, as we know from reading the newspapers, may well have been the source or could have been a source or a cook could have been a source.
It's really no different than the principles at issue in the Bureau of Prisons case in the Ninth Circuit, where you couldn't have individuals having daily contact with prisoners having being a possible source of drugs or drug users, because like the employees here, Bureau of Prison employees in those situations were obligated to ensure the safety and security of those prisoners. They were obligated to report misuse. They could not carry out those duties if they were drug users, because such users simply have no incentive to report. They could be open to blackmail. They could be open to...
No, but the only question is whether or not the government's interest is such, or one of the questions is whether the government's is such that the requirement for individualized suspicion can be accepted.
You know, the intrusion on the privacy interest here is minimal. Every one of these individuals has a background investigation conducted. Every one of them knows when they hired on that they go through the CPR and first aid training. Everyone are told they have to mentor and monitor for drug use. Everyone understands that you're dealing with a unique body of individuals who are at risk.
This is random. This is not a one-time only, as in Skinner and Von Raab.
Your Honor, right? This court, in BNSF, the most recent decision of this court, called this minimally intrusive.
I know. And this, that was a rulemaking.
Honestly, Your Honor,
it's not
between...
a constitutional challenge.
It was a constitutional challenge. It was a facial challenge to the constitutionality of that rule. Just as this is a facial constitution as this policy, there's really no difference there. The Constitution is the same in either event.
So you think we've reached the point where any time you have any direct contact with someone who has used drugs, that's enough for a random drug testing regime?
Your Honor, this is much bigger than that. I don't think that's necessarily objectionable, but this case doesn't present that situation alone. This case, we're comfortable with Your Honor's test in Stigo, in which it said there was substantial interest of the government and it's minimally intrusive and it will be sustained. The interest here is at least substantial. The pant is full. We have a situation where
why did the secretary take 14 years to implement it then?
Nobody likes fighting with unions, I suspect. We don't have a reason
in
this record.
No, but this is such a critical special need of the government the fact that the union doesn't like it is not going to stop the government.
Well, the reason doesn't appear of record, Your Honor, so I'm not going to go outside the record.
No, I agree, but the facts are the regulation was promulgated and that it wasn't implemented for over 14 years.
And the affidavit of Dawson shows that, and Nagel shows that the reason it wasn't because of the opposition of the NFE. And that was the reason stated in this record, but, and that is the only reason stated in this record.
I understand your point. Do you have any other points you want to make, or do my colleagues have questions?
One last question. On the residential facility, I'm trying to figure out why that would be, why that would matter here, because it would seem the logic would apply to any school that you have contact with youth, say at-risk youth, say a school that's for kids who have had trouble.
I think it matters because the only way you can get drugs into a residential facility in which the students are not allowed to leave, they don't have cars, is to have someone bring them in. Now, students themselves are searched. Their visitors are searched once they get contact. There is a huge intrusion on the privacy of the individuals because that's what Congress has mandated.
Every visitor to one of these is searched?
Well, the individual is searched after the visitor leaves, so his belongings are searched. They toss their lockers on a weekly or monthly basis, just on a random basis. They search the facility because of the nature of the drugs. But if you are in that residential remote facility...
That's because of the past history of drug use at these centers?
Yes. That's in this record that these searches are conducted of students and enrollees on a regular basis because of drug use. Because
it's very important to be careful here. Judge Kavanaugh asked you because of a past history. All we have in this record is that there were 8 employees in the past several years, and we don't know what several is.
No, Your Honor.
Were found to have used drugs.
We're searching the enrollees. We're not searching the employees.
I know, but the issue here involves the employees, not the enrollees.
You cannot divorce the enrollees from the employees because the employees have a duty to make sure the enrollees don't do drugs.
I wonder why that didn't apply in Veronia.
There wasn't that issue in Veronia, Your Honor. The drug testing policy there didn't encompass teachers. That didn't get a rise into Knox County.
Exactly.
Well, that doesn't mean there's a negative implication that teachers could be tested. The Sixth Circuit said they can be. So we're not asking for the broad-tail testing of teachers in this case. That doesn't require this case, but it might be justifiable, as the Sixth Circuit held. But we're in a situation where the only way these drugs get in is through employees, and an employee who cannot monitor for drug use.
In all due respect, the record does not show that. There are lots of people who come to these remote centers who the secretary's regulation does not cover, such as the welder who comes in to provide vocational training, the delivery men, the mailmen. I mean, there are a lot of people not covered who could be bringing drugs in.
They could, and we deal with that by searching the enrollees. But the employees have a unique requirement here, and that is to monitor for drug use. Just as the drug use by a prison guard or a prison contact employee could ameliorate or diminish their expectation or requirement to report drug usage, so too here. A person at these sites will not report drug usage if he is in fact using drugs. We do not expect that to happen. That's very similar to the situation this court encountered in Cheney and what the Ninth Circuit found in the Bureau of Prisons situation. It's really not a stretch at all. This is quite unique.
In Cheney, it was the counselors themselves, though. Right here, we're going a couple layers out from just the direct.
In a very real sense, because every single employee can be a mentor or an informal mentor to each in one of these. Each one of these required individuals could be, in a sense, a drug counselor. In a sense, because they are the examples, they are the mentors.
That's a pretty aggressive reading of the phrase, in a sense.
Well, perhaps, Your Honor, but you have to remember the context where this arises. And this is at-risk youth with a history of drug use in a remote residential setting. We're not asking for anything beyond that. This is quite unique.
Anything further?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Give you a couple of minutes.
I would start. Where do I start? But First, when you use the words mentoring, monitoring, and I forget the three M's that they use, you're now describing just about every supervisor in the federal government. I mean, that's what supervisors do. They mentor and they monitor.
But it's a residential facility. That's the key. I mean, that seems the key distinction, a residential facility and at-risk youth and the program. Just common sense tells you the program's going to be in trouble if the employees are using drugs.
Well, and I guess 2 points there is that, you still have to show the nexus to what the harm is. Drug use in and of itself is not the same as a train, with passengers going off the tracks. I mean, would there be some harm? Yeah, but we're not necessarily going to have the magnitude of risk.
If you're doing a program to help young people who have used drugs in many cases, and you're taking them to a residential facility, which just common sense again tells you that is a prescription for trouble if there's a lot of drugs at the residential facility. It's just destined to fail if you have employees who are using drugs, right? I mean, that's what Congress found in 1995.
And I'm not sure whether the program is going to fail or succeed is really a test, because you start getting into about the integrity of the program, which I think under Chandler and Von Raab is, we don't look at whether the integrity of the program is there, we look at what the actual harm is going to be. And from that standpoint, I think it's a dicey road to go down. I just want to touch on Vernonia.
Can I ask one other follow-up? Sorry. You distinguish the Ninth Circuit case dealing with Bureau of Prison Employees, or do you just think that case was wrong?
Well, I think they want to characterize the Job Corps centers as prisons. They're not prisons. These are not.
But it's residential facilities with obviously people at risk.
But more to the point is that, they still haven't really established exactly why it's the office clerk. We have no idea how much connection the office clerk has to the residential staff. The residential staff hold CDL, so they're already drug tested. So the ones that are actually going to really be in the residences are the residential staff. They're already drug tested. The drug and alcohol counselors, because we've never gotten a chance to really talk position by position, I think we'd have to look at it. But under Cheney, I think we'd probably have a hard time arguing drug and alcohol counselors. So we just think the first thing you have to do is let's look at position by position. If the office clerk doesn't go to the residential area, if the office clerk, files papers a la the position description, it's hard for us to see what the nexus is just because there happens to be a residential facility.
But everyone in a prison, every prison employee could be tested, right?
Under the Ninth Circuit decision, that's
a lot of what goes on in prisons, of course, is rehabilitation. That's the goal for most prisoners.
My presumption is they're showing a strong nexus to safety there, though. You're talking about people presumably who have a criminal past, potential. There's no record here that these people might have issues, but there's no history here that there's nothing in the record that I've seen that would suggest that they are, violent criminals or something along the lines where you really would have a real safety issue. Mm-hmm. And the other point on Vernonia is that
that's an interesting point, because the Supreme Court's analysis of prisons has been this substantial deference to the correctional facilities a need to maintain discipline at the prisons. And if by analogy you look at what the school district in Vernonia was facing, the Supreme Court described it as a rebellion. Here we don't have any evidence of that. I mean, the secretary took over 14 years to implement this thing.
And that's what we keep describing as a bureaucratic exercise to come into compliance, because that's what the letter said. We're not sure it was anything more than that someone was checking off the box. They never came into compliance. And that's what we think the evidence shows. In Vernonia, the real point with Vernonia is that there the court made clear numerous times that these were students. They did not have the same rights as adults. And so even they did talk about the role model effect, but that's because the role models were the ones with the drug problem. Here, there's absolutely no record whatsoever that the role models here are the drug users. And so taking the role model sort of rationale that sort of is used a little bit in Vernonia and applying it to the group that doesn't have the problem, if any group has a problem, is really, sort of taking apples and applying it to oranges.
I thought all the employees are the role models here.
Well, that's what I'm saying. In Vernonia, it was the students who were described as it was the drug using students who were described as the role models. Nobody has made any allegation here that the staff are drug using role models. I mean, they're, I mean, that's the point.
There's an affidavit at 145 put in by Linda Guzik, director of the Trapper Creek Job Corps CCC near Darby, Montana. She directs and supervises all aspects of the center's operation. At paragraph 6 on page 145, she says, students of the Trapper Creek Center are tested on suspicion of drug use. Any employee can report suspicion of drug use by a student. During 2009 to 2010 program year, I take it that's 1 year, not two, during that program year, 8 students who had enrolled at the center during the previous year, 2008-2009, tested positive upon suspicion of drug use. So drugs are coming into the center. How can they come in if the students are isolated except by virtue of the employees?
I think that's a little unclear because we'd have to know whether the students went home at all during that time period. My understanding is that it's when the students come back from home that a lot of times they test positive, not necessarily when they've been only at these centers. I think if it was remanded, we might be able to develop the record more.
Well, I didn't realize that they were allowed to go home. Is that clear?
Yeah. I mean, I think for Christmas break and those things, they're allowed to go home. The other point that I wanted to raise was that the testing here is actually more strict than the testing they're applying to the students, where there is some evidence problems. See, the students know that they're going to get tested. Then they have 45 days. If they do pop the drug test, they have 45 days, so they know when it's going to happen. The employees are now subjected to random testing, even though there's no evidence of a problem amongst the employees. So it's actually a more...
The potential problem is not limited to drug use by the employees. It's that or they're bringing in drugs that get to the students.
Yeah, and there's just no evidence whatsoever in the record.
All we've got is that there, and maybe it's because maybe it is associated with going home, I don't know, but we have evidence that there's some drug use among the students. So there's some concern about stopping it, right?
Sure, yeah. We'd like to know who's the source before.
I thought there were all these other people who come to these centers who are not under...
Yeah, I mean, to my knowledge, they're not fenced, these are not, again, secure facility. I mean, it's a residential facility, it's a vocational center, but I don't, you have the contractors coming on every day that bring people... The national contractors come in and bring people off-site to, go work on their vocation. So there's plenty of people going on and off.
By off-site,
even on an army base, it is secure. You have people going off on and off all day. So
they go off-site to work on vocational training.
Right.
Does off-site mean into the forest or?
Yeah, or other sites. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the case under advisement.